This is John Golly Galsworthy, recorded by Chris Alden Lee on the 17th of June, 2011. John Galsworthy, Part 2. You called at South Georgia on the way back from your term at Halley. Was that for a particular purpose, and what did you make of the place?
That's right. When we went south first, we actually called into South Georgia.
On the way down?
On the way down. Right. Unfortunately, the whaling had finished then, so I never ever saw the whaling. But the station was still in quite good order, and I think with a little bit of effort, it could have been up and running. Anyway, I went to Halley, and when we came back, the government had decided to pull out of South Georgia because there was no whaling, and so the administration was being moved. And I don't know the ins and outs between the government, but anyway, Bass were going to take it over. And so that summer, Dave Hill went in with a group of people to start converting Shackleton House to suit Bass needs. So when I came up from Halley, I then took over from him because he went down to Adelaide. So I then continued at South Georgia for the rest of the summer with two or three other people.
Doing what?
We were converting Shackleton House into, because it had a huge games room at the end of the building. And so that was converted into offices, basically. And they'd actually put up some aerials as well, which I wasn't concerned with. That was already finished. So it was basically finishing off the inside of Shackleton House, ready for Bass and the scientists to come in the following year. So I did that for the rest of that summer. And then I went off to South America. Got off the ship in Montevideo and travelled around South America, in which time I worked with the missionaries. I mean, I'm not religious, but I met these missionaries and I spent some time working with those, which was really interesting.
Well, I'd heard that John Galsworthy ended up in a convent, is that right?
Well, no, it was a mission station. It was a mission station, yeah. They were really good people.
How do you fall into that, John?
Partly through the Falklands, because the Falklands in those days came under the Diocese of Argentina. And again, the Falklands were in such a small place, you got to know people, and their foreman at work was, in fact, a lay preacher. You would have never thought so, but he was. And so it was this tentative contact between the Falklands and Argentina, really, and I got the name of this chap up in the north of the Argentine. And off I trotted, expecting to go to a church, but ended up in this mission station, which might have been quite difficult, but they're great people, and I'm not religious, and I let them know I'm not religious, and we got on fine. And I actually ended up building a lorry for them. They had a lorry, just a chassis. And so I built the back of it for them, you know, for general cargo. So I did that for 3 months with them up there. And then continued on round and went up to Paraguay and then back to Montevideo to go south again. But it was quite funny because I never had a contract again. There was a bit of a mess up, actually, because a contract got sent from Rio to the Montevideo, I think, and I never caught up with it. And Ricky Chin, who was going to be base leader again at South Georgia, he's in the office and said, well, will he be there? No, Golly said, if he said he'd be there, he'd be there. So when I got to Montevideo and I'm there and Ricky walked through the square and I said, Ricky... And his face lit up, you know, he was back, you know, he's made it. Anyway, so then we went down to South Georgia and took over from the government. And so we had 18 months taking over from the government and a lot of alterations to the base. And it was a big base to run. It was quite hard work, actually. There was a lot to do for us. And some of the equipment wasn't in too good a condition.
Well, I was going to ask you if it was pretty run down by the time the government finished with it.
Some of it was. Mm. The mechanic, a chap called John Quigley, he was brilliant. He was very good. So the engines and that Dad Etchells looked after, they were fine, and the fridges. But it was a lot of the bits and pieces. I mean, like the cement mix. I mean, this is a silly story. The cement mix had a flat tyre. Well, it took us all day to mend a puncture because the wheels wouldn't go round, and then we couldn't, you know. A lot of it was run down, but I think they'd let it go a little bit, but it was just a big job and the changeover to what we wanted from what the government wanted. And so it was quite hard work again, but it was a great place to be.
Why?
South George has always been a really popular place. From the days I lived in the Falklands, everybody wanted to go to South Georgia to work. Despite the manager there, a chap called Coleman. Nobody liked Coleman. He was like the king of South Georgia. And, you know, what he said went. And I think he could be bloody difficult too. King Coleman, they used to call him. But everybody wanted to go there because it was great. The skiing and the animals and the bird life. And you could go hiking and, you know, get around. We never actually, when I was there, in all the time I was there, we never did any big trips because we were sort of confined to the station. We hadn't got the infrastructure or to go too far. I mean, we went out and we went camping on the Bath Peninsula across. We could get across there and go camping and go reindeer hunting because the reindeer there was, we used to go over and get those. And then the other bases wanted them then, because once Bass were there, or can you send us down reindeer?
Some venison.
Venison. So we used to go shooting reindeer. And fortunately, there was Owen Summers, who was the Met man, was a Falkland Islander. And he'd lived on the... He was a young chap, but he'd lived on the farms and knew how to kill sheep and skin sheep and that. So he taught us all how to butcher the reindeer. So, you know, that was another string to my bow, was butchering reindeer. And
did you imagine, as a carpenter signing up to go to the Antarctica, you might end up...
Not a bit. I mean, it's amazing what you do. I mean, the other thing at South Georgia was tying the ships up. I mean, the ships all came in and we had to tie them up, and you you just got to do it, you know. And I quite like the boats as well. I used to run one of the boats around the bay under Ricky's tuition, because Ricky was an ex Thames bargeman, yeah. Training, I think it was.
How busy was South Georgia then? Because was Gritviken still reasonably well populated?
No, it wasn't.
It deserted, was it?
No, well, yes, it was, except that there was Torsten and Louis. Torsten was a Norwegian man who'd been there for 30 years, I think, a storeman. But he worked like hell there. And him and Louis stayed, and the story, I think, was that the Russians were... Because we used to get Russian ships coming in to take on water, because everybody wanted South Georgia water because it was so good, and they'd bring the Russian trawlers in for give them a run ashore. And I what I think was the Russians were looking for a base in the South Atlantic, and they were looking at South Georgia to have a base for the summer use. And Torsten was going to be showing them round, I think. But the Russians never... And so the Biscoe came in and left. And left Torsten and Louis there because the Russians were going to come in. He was going to look, show them round, and they were then going to take them back to South America. But the Russians never came. So these two got stuck for the winter. So we had two Robinson Crusoes with us for the winter, which worked fine. You know, Torsten in the end went and lived on his own, actually, over in the whaling station. I don't think he could put up with us youngsters. But, I mean, they'd work like hell on the boats and paint the boats and keep them going and turn the engines over, and the boats are dearse. And I'm sure they would have gone, you know, they would have started up then. Well, they did, you know, they'd get them really in good nick.
So the population of South Georgia in the immediate post-government period when Bass took over the base, it was simply the one building. Nearly everybody lived in that one building.
Yeah, what happened was Bass left. Sorry. The government left.
Yeah.
So there was all the government houses, but we lived in Shackleton House, which was built for the single men of South Georgia. So we all lived in there. But then the houses were turned into... One of them we turned into a Met office. And, of course, that created a lot of work for me to build benches and stuff. And one of the other ones was turned into a more of a science thing. But, of course, these scientists... All of a sudden, they had all these buildings they could use. They went empire building. They said, oh, we need a whole house. You know, we can't have one little office. So, there was 10 of us. 10 of us and then Louis and... 12 altogether there for the winter. So, so we worked and did things. And we had... Dave Walton was with us. That was his first trip south, who became an international star of... botany in the world and other people. Other little things are funny with Bass. We had a chap called Clive Stevenson. with Gullyments, because he was their entertainment officer. And I mean, this is a silly thing he did, South. His sister had a birthday.
Yeah.
And we said, oh, you're going to send her some flowers, aren't you? Oh, no, he said. No, I'm not. Go on, you've got to send your sister flowers. No. Well, you send them. Well, OK, then. Didn't know his sister at all. Not at all. So Dad Etchells and I sent her a cauliflower through into Flora. And apparently it all came crimped nicely, all beautifully done. And the next day we sent her a bunch of flowers. You know, this is a daft thing you do. No idea who the girl was. We met her later, in actual fact. You know, she took it all in good part. But,
So how do you contact Interflora in 1970 from South Georgia?
Well, it was all Morse-coded. Morse-coded to the Falklands. And then the girls there would type it up on airmail letters and send it off. Well, I'm not sure it went to the Falklands. I mean, the air letters were all typed. I think they probably send airmail. You know, probably an airmail letter. They might have. I think it must have been airmail letters then.
And money would disappear from your account.
That's it. And more money. You didn't worry about that too much. You know, the money went.
Yeah. So you came back to. I'm getting. Because you, I think you went to South Georgia. That was all the on the way back from Halle.
No, I did the summer.
And we sent you back for the summer?
Yes.
Okay. And then he came home again via Ushuaia.
Oh, that's it, yeah. Then I came home.
And you thought you finished with Bass, but you hadn't?
I hadn't given up Bass, but I'd been out of England in 5 years. And I got back to Southampton, and Bill Sloman was there.
This time you did have a Bill Sloman.
Have a Bill Sloman one. And he said, oh, then, golly, I want just a chap I want to see. Oh, what have I done? No, you know, Bill was a great bloke, he was magic. We're building at Stonington, and that's another place down the peninsula people wanted to go. We're building at Stonington, you know, OK, Bill, I'll go. Well, let me know. No, Bill, put me down, I'll go. And he was really good, because everybody got enthusiastic, then they get home and meet their girlfriend, or back into their life, and then they say, oh, I don't think I will go, but I knew I'd go. No, I'll go, Bill. Well, all right, let me know, though. Anyway, of course, I get home, and my mum and my dad had died in a few years before, so just my mum. And I hadn't got the heart to it's off again in a few months. Anyway, you know, when sufficient time had gone by, I sort of said, I'm going back south again, going down to Stonington. So at the end of that year again, you know, I had a few months at home, then I went off down to Stonington. But I stopped at Signey on the way.
How was the maternal reaction?
What, with my mother? Oh, she thought I was nuts. What do you want to go knock yourself away down there for? You know, she thought I was nuts doing it, really. I guess it, you know, you're sort of down there, you're all with a few chaps, you know, and I think, you know. But
she didn't kick up a fuss?
Oh, no. She was fine, you know, just thought you were nuts going and shutting yourself away for another few months.
So Bill organised you to go to Stonington.
Yes, that would be that's him. Right.
What year would that be?
You know, I don't know, 66, 66.
This was summer only.
Yeah, it was a summer. It was a summer job. Yes.
And what were you doing at Stonington?
The base was a big dog base. A lot of people there, and the base really wasn't big enough. So we put a huge extension on, big double story extension on the end of it. There was three of us went down to do that. So, but because it was quite far south, we actually stopped on the way down. We stopped at, you know, I get muddled up where I was in times because I went to Signey. That was later or earlier. We went to Argentine Islands, I know, and we put some buildings up at Argentine Islands. We put a store hut and an extension to the balloon shed for the making the gas for the balloons, the hydrogen shed. Mm-hmm. And I think we went from there. We must have gone from there straight down to Stonington, I think. And then, so we put the building up through the summer. And one chap stayed down, then I came out.
But, well, this was your first time down Marguerite Bay, down the West Coast, effectively.
Yes.
So tell me what you felt about the relationship between what you were seeing now on the West Coast of the Antarctic Peninsula and what you experienced at Halley. Was it completely different worlds?
Oh, yes. Yeah, and it was quite different with the people as well, because Halley Bay, the ships used to go in later, and the Perla Dan and the Kista Dan prior to that used to leave England later. And so only the Halley Bay people would be on it in the main. the peninsula people had gone earlier, and so they were all scattered around the, changing around the bases, because people would swap around bases from, as they moved, if they did 2 years or whatever. So the Halibay people were quite out on a limb on their own and weren't really known by the peninsula people. But that did change as time went on, and so you did get to know other people. So you were in a slightly different world, being...
Second-class citizens?
Depending which side of the coin you were talking about. If you were Halibay, you were definitely first class, and if you were peninsula, you were definitely first class. And the Stonington people, you thought they were a cut above everyone. They were big dog people. There were some good dog people down there, and because they spent their life travelling down there. So they were almost a little group of their own, the Stonington people as well. But of course, everybody... And everybody wanted to go to Stonington as well. That was another place.
Because of the dogs.
Because of the dogs and the travelling and that. Yeah. Yeah. But Argentine Islands were nice. That was a good base.
What was good about Argentine Islands?
The scenery around there is just fantastic. And it's fairly landlocked. So the sea was calm and we had canoes and we could go canoeing around the icebergs and stuff. But the base was really well run. The bases go through periods of good and bad, but generally good. Stonington went through a bit of a bad patch at one time. But Argentine Islands, the chaps are really, really proud of it. And if you were on the ship and you were going to Argentine Islands, you said, oh, I better dress up, better put a suit on, because the Argentine Islands people would all come on the ship dressed up. And the space was spotless. They'd have it spotless. And after a relief, you know, it was cardboard and mess. And they used to actually go up the jetty and around there with a magnet on string and pick up all the nails and that. You know, the place was immaculate. They had a good few years of it being, and it was just a good place to be, you know. We had some good fun there, you know. The weather was generally a lot better because you're quite well north too. That was a good place. Good crowd of people.
And you were building at Argentine Islands as well, weren't you?
Yes, yes.
What were you doing there?
That's where I put the store shed. And it was a store shed. No, Signy was the generator shed. Right. Signy was the generator shed. I came up from... That must have been from the Armco, I think. I came up from Halley, I think. After the Armco base. Because I'd just summered there. And I came up and then I finished the summer at Signy with Jack Temple, who unfortunately just died. So, and him, I helped him and his mate, we built the Jenny shed at Signy that year,
right,
for the rest of the year.
So let's go back to Halley then, and the Armco Halley, which was Halley
3.
What was your experience of doing the Armco work? This is Big Al's idea for these motorway tubes, effectively.
That's right.
Motorway subway tubes. Does that work okay?
I think they work quite well, in fact. You know, it was quite hard work putting them together because they're quite hefty chunks of corrugated steel. And we actually had Dad Etchell's made a sort of a crane on the front of one of the tractors to try and to lift them up. And so, you know, we built the tubes first and then had to blank the ends off, and then you built the huts inside, and there was a sort of a steel grillagey framework because the bottoms were round, so we had to build up this metal lattice work of base for the hut to sit on and build the huts in there. But I was just there for the summer, so you know, we got them basically, we got as many of the tubes and the huts up as we could, and then it was left to a gang to do the, but I think they were quite successful. You know, the next time they did wooden tubes that I didn't have anything to do with, but I don't think they worked too well. The interlocking didn't work as well as was hoped, I think.
Well, tell me about Big Al. And the other building guy you must have come across was Jim Shercliffe.
Oh, yeah, I knew Jim. Yeah, I knew Jim from the Falklands, you see. I've known him for years and years.
Oh, tell me about Big Al first. What was your feelings about him? This is Al Smith, isn't
it? Yeah, Big Al, yeah. He was a great bloke, both in size and very enthusiastic. In all honesty, I don't think he was all that good at looking after men. Because he drove himself, he didn't give you breaks as either. You know, so that I mean, we all got on well together. It was fine. We all worked together, and he was good, you know. And but I think he should have given us breaks, like going, like having the day off and doing something different or whatever. It would have been a little bit better. And even the last time I went down, when I went down Halley 5, you know, Ben Hodges and I went down to the old base, but we had to do it at night. You know, we'd worked 12 hours, and we had to go and do it at night. And I think you would have been, you know, just to sort of say, look, you've been there before, you helped build it, you know, have half a day off. And for the other people as well, you know, I think it... But otherwise, he was fine. If I could fault him, that would be, you know, a little bit of a moan, if that's the right word to put it.
And Jim Shercliffe, who you'd known for Donkey Shoes?
Yeah, I met Jim in the Falklands first, who came down with Ben Hodges, because Ben was another chap that spent many years down. I mean, he came down and went back, I don't know, Lord knows how many years after he was meant to. And they got a job in the Falklands building some houses. So I met them in the Falklands while I was there. And then we wintered together. And, Jim's a chap that I got on well with. I still see him and we're still friendly and send Christmas cards to each other. Yeah, he was another good bloke, yeah.
What finally brought you back north? Did you become? Was there a point at which you felt your Antarctic time was drawing to a close?
Just think how this worked. When I came back, I came back and the Aldabra was being run, which in the Indian Ocean, which was going to be the American base for Vietnam War, I think. And they were going to flatten Aldabra and turn it into an airport, but then the scientists got there and decided it was of scientific interest.
What was it called again?
Aldabra. And they needed people to go out there. Well, I mean, no, it's the Antarctic and the Indian Ocean, but you needed people that were used to going to odd places. And so they got on to the survey people, because there's still the university link, so people know what's going on a bit. And so they got on to the Antarctic people. And so Big Al, through a chap called Len Mole, he was another base leader down there, he got the job with Crown Agents. Can't think of it in a minute. He got a job with the Aldabra people anyway, that were running it in England. So then they needed people to do it. So Big Al went down to do the building, the initial building of the station. And then I came up from the bases and I just was at the right place at the right time. They need somebody to go out as a manager to run the place. And I just happened to be in the right place at the right time. So I got the job then to go to the Seychelles. So I did that. So I went out there for 18 months. And you think you've just come from the Antarctic and I'm in the taxi going from the airport into Mahé and there's palm trees and the sea. And I thought, damn, man, this is how I'm living. And the job, you know, you put your bathing costume on in the morning and that was it, you know. So that, I think that's really what stopped. You know, that was the end of my Antarctic trips, apart from going down to Halley 5 later.
Yeah. And you worked also in Kenya and South Africa.
Yeah, well, what happened was one of the doctors from the South was South African. And he said, oh, you know, come and meet us. So my air ticket from the Seychelles, from Kenya to South Africa, that's Kenya home. And I thought, that's silly, you know. This is where I've taken my chances, how I travelled in South America. I said to the Seychelles people, can I go from South Africa? I'll pay the difference in the air ticket. Which was next to nothing, or I didn't pay it. I think it was the same anyway. So then I hitchhiked and bussed down through to South Africa, I was a year late getting home that time. So I ended up in, you know, going down through Kenya, Tanzania, Malawi, and into South Africa, where I met some. I went through Rhodesia during the war, which was quite interesting. And while I was there, I met some people. Buying curios and souvenirs to take into South Africa. And I ended up going on a farm near Johannesburg and met this chap who was one of the main curio dealers and ended up staying there. And in the end, I managed to get my visas and work permits and I went back to South Africa for 12 years.
12 years?
12 years, yeah. So I travelled all around South Africa with a 10-ton lorry. It was about as big as a double-decker bus, and it was set up like a warehouse. So I'd go around all the outlets, Kruger Park, Cape Town, Port Elizabeth, and all over with this lorry selling. I was basically a salesman, but it was but it lived on the lorry, had a cabin on it to live in, and it was great.
Did you ever feel threatened at all at that time?
No, I didn't. It was before the trouble started, really. I mean, a lot of South Africans carry guns, and this chap I worked for is a little bit of a gun man, and he said to me about carrying a gun. I said, Frank, if I've got to carry a gun, I'm not here. And so it was fine. No, I used to park anywhere down the roads, you know, from between Johannesburg and Cape Town. I'd just pull in laybys and park for the night. And, no, it was fine then. It was fine.
So what dragged you back to the Antarctic in the era of Halley 5?
Knowing people. Basically, you know, people were looking for people to go south again and help with Halley 5, and I was still in the running. So I was contacted to go back down and help with Halley 5.
Was this a formal contact from Bass? Or was
it... Yes. It was, yes, it must have come from through the grapevine, and I was contacted to go back to Halley 5 again. Yeah, so that was just being in the know, and so down I went. You know, it was a difficult year, that, I must admit. It wasn't as easy as might have been, because a lot of... I went down initially to be just in charge of the carpenters, but when I got there, I ended up being in charge of the day shift, and there was a lot of army people there, and I've never been in the army. I've got no idea about army, how they work, how they think, and it was sort of quite difficult to be in charge, because I wasn't really in charge. That was a trouble, and it got thrust on me. And so it's quite difficult trying to do bits and pieces. And there was almost too many other people over me in charge. There was Big Al, and there was a surveyor for the company, and there was another chap who was going to take over. And I tended to be a bit at the end of the line with certain things, because we were trying to put these containers on. That was one of the things. It was a nightmare. And I said, you won't put them on like that. They were trying to get them on too perfect. And I said, onto the building, onto the platform. And they were really well made, these containers, but they were trying to straighten them up too perfectly, and it was never going to work. And in the end, I said to Big Al, look, I'm having nothing to do with these containers. When they're straight, then I'll carry on. Just pull it this way, pull it that way. And then they'd go away, and the ice moved. You know, the ice moved, and by the time we went back 12 hours later, they'd be different anyway, you know, so... So it was a little bit difficult, but it was fun. You know, it was not quite what I'd have... I'm pleased I went. But I said a lot of it was the army, and I'm not knocking the army, but they definitely think differently to an ordinary person. So that made it a little bit difficult, their reaction. But no, it was well worth going, and an experience I wouldn't have missed. But, you know, a little bit... I'd say a little bit difficult, but fine.
So was that an unhappy ending to your Antarctic relationship? Because that was the last time
Yes.
You worked there.
Well, I went to South Georgia since. I've been to South Georgia since.
Oh, you have?
No, it wasn't... I wouldn't say it was an unhappy...
Right.
No, it wasn't an unhappy time at all. It went well. It was just a little difficult.
All right. Okay.
A little bit difficult.
Tell me about the model of Halley 5 that you built.
Well, I'm a good fiddler. And I built a sledge at Halley, and blowing my own trumpet, I think it's the best model sledge that I've seen, in actual fact. And I still like fiddling, you know, I still fiddle with stuff. And they needed a model of Halley 5 being built. So they got me to go up to Cambridge and work in one of the places to build this model, which I think still around somewhere.
Is it in the showcase in the foyer of... I don't know
where it is. I heard somewhere that it was put on show somewhere, so maybe it is. I really don't know, but it was interesting doing it. As I said, I'm a good fiddler to do it and build it, and I think it was quite... Well, if it's still going, it must have been quite successful, but it was an interesting thing
to
do.
Well, there is a model in the foyer of Cambridge now, but I'm not clear whether it's Halley 5 or a futuristic model of the next...
But is it on legs?
Yes.
If it's on like RSJ-looking legs, metal legs, I guess it's it. Yes, it must be it.
Yours?
Yes. Yeah. I would think so then in that case.
Well, the next one's on legs as well, isn't it?
Number six. Well, the other one's on feet more than legs. Okay. I think I saw a picture in the last Bass magazine, yeah. And I think they're on more feet than legs.
Okay. All right. Mm. Weather havens. I don't quite know what that... There's a note here about weather havens.
Ah, yeah. Now, this is another little difference in the building. As I said earlier, when we did Grillage Village, we had two cabooses and the cooks booked on primuses. When I went down with the weather haven, they were already built there because we were the second year building Halley 5. And I think the weather havens are Canadian Army tents. And I think that Bass said to the Canadians, I guess, we need accommodation for 40 people. And that's what they did. They supplied two tents for 40 people with all the equipment. And they were really well fitted out. You know, the bathrooms and the toilets and the washrooms were really good. And there was Alan Weirden was cooking down there and he had a really good kitchen. And there was, in the past with Bass, there's always been a problem with power. Well, not the power so much, the diesel to run the power. So it's always been a little bit short on power. As the years have gone on, it's got better and they've got better methods of transporting it. But what amazed me, because power's always short on the bases, really, but what really tickled me, one of the first things I saw when I went in the weather haven was a hot air hand dryer. And I thought, I cannot believe it, there's this darn hot air hand dryer. But they were really good, you know, they were double skin canvas or material tent with a floor, and the bunk rooms were set out. And then I say the washrooms, and then there was the other one had the kitchen and the lounge in it. And they worked really well and they were comfortable to live in.
How do they cope with high winds?
They seem fine, yes. And I think they... I'm not sure about the burying, because that's usually the problem at Halley, the weight of the snow on the top. The end of the first year, when we went, they were fine. They were still out of the snow. I'm not sure, because I think they were used the next year as well, and I'm not sure whether they started to collapse with the snow weight on them, but I wasn't there then too. But they were very good.
There's a couple of stories from Dave Hill, which I'm going to throw at you. One concerns Gorgonzola cheese. Mm. Do you know what I'm talking about?
I do indeed.
Strange smell in the bunk room.
Well, like I said from the word go, you know, we met at Cambridge and we've always been pals. We shared a bunk room with us. And my
aunt, this was 67?
67. And I had this Gorgonzola cheese given to me to take down, which I kept in the bunk room, and I used to bring it out, you know, just bits of it. And I suppose over the time it got riper and riper and gradually got smelling more like socks, I guess. And whether it is, because I was on the top bunk, so whether the smell got him a bit before me, but that was certainly true, the story of the cheese, yes, with me and my Gorgonzola cheese that I had hidden in the bunk room. Which people enjoyed. They didn't complain about the smell when I got it out, but that was...
One day I went in and Golly was already there in the cupboard on his hands and knees in the wardrobe. And that's how you were rumbled.
That's it, yeah. Found out what the smell was.
And there was an incident on the maiden voyage of the Bransfield on her return to the UK when you got sucked into the air conditioning.
Oh, yeah. That was Dave and I,
Tell me about that.
Well, the Bransfield, the engine... The air conditioning wasn't quite good enough, so they got us, the engineers got Dave and I to build some ducting. And of course, we had these great sheets of plywood we were doing, and we were down in the engine room, and there's this huge fan going. I mean, luckily it had got grills and that, but because we carry this board in and the fan sucked us, and we sort of ended up between the plywood and the fan, you know, flattened against this blooming thing, and because Fanny always makes a big story of it anyway, but it's quite fun. You know, there we are, get it off, you know, push it off, you know. I don't think we'd have ended up chips, but it was, we certainly ended up flat against this cowling for the fans, yes, yeah.
What were you doing dressed as a bunny girl?
Oh, well, you see, people have been talking, haven't they?
It's hardly the right temperature for a bunny girl.
No. Well, the first winter we were there, because it was in the days of the bunny girls and the main Hugh Hefner time, and Playboy obviously was quite a popular magazine. So we, at midwinter, Christmas was always a little bit of a non-event because it was the middle of the summer. We were always busy. There's a lot of people coming and going. But midwinter, June the 21st, which we're now celebrating, was the main party. And the cooks would put on a really good spread. And, you know, I thought to myself one day, how about if we dressed up as bunny girls and did the serving? So I got a couple of other chaps to do it with me. And we had this highly secret sewing bunny costumes and making the ears and all that. And nobody knew. Only one chap walked in on us one day and found out. But he was very good. He didn't say anything. And so, of course, when they came out to serve the meal, out come the... We didn't know what to put on their feet, so we wore these big boots that we worked in, you know. So we had the ears and the cuffs and we cut up some material to make the costumes and their bust and all that. Well, it went down really well, you know, because damn people kept playing with your tail, didn't they? Playing, get your hand off my tail. But it was really good fun, you know. It was fun making them. Because there was Bill somebody, one of the scientists, you see. So we all mixed together. Bill, one of the scientists, did it. Where's the other one? Not Paul Coslett.
It doesn't matter.
No, I can't remember who the people were. But, I mean, it was a selection of people through the base, and so it was really good fun.
There's one little bit I missed out here, which I think is quite important to talk about, and this is when you went to South Georgia in the 90s. And you were working with Ben Hodges, and you were actually... Were you not helping to restore the Wayless Church?
That's right, yes. Through the years, as... I'm a little bit out of date with Bass, because it's a long time, but the whaling station now is such a tourist industry down there that the whaling church has always been well looked after, and there's chap Tim Carr down there with his wife, and he did a lot. He was a shipwright, but a very good builder anyway. So he'd done a lot of work on strengthening the church because the buildings tend to fall over. Mm. So they needed somebody to re-roof it. So they, the South Georgia government by then got together with Bob Burton was running it, and they needed somebody to go down and re-roof the church. And again, it was a name. My name came forward. So I got the job to go down, and then I needed people, so in fact I got Ben to come as well. You know, we were looking for somebody, so I got Ben to come and a couple of others.
Was it a big challenge to repair the church?
It was, yes. Luckily,
in what respect?
It's quite a big job, and South Georgia's very windy, extremely windy, and luckily what made it easier, the army were there still. It was the end of their time, but they had scaffolding. So we were able to scaffold round the building to get up to the right height. But we still had no real materials. We had to make roof ladders out of stuff. But Tim had, he'd gone around to the other whaling stations and got lots of timbers to make the main beams that we needed to replace. But so it was a question of stripping off the roof. But with the wind and the weather, so the wind and the rain didn't get in, and the wind doesn't get in and damage more to lift the roof off. Mm. So, you know, we had to sort of try and work by stripping bays of the roof and then redoing it. But, you know, we really had... And the ceilings from the inside were nailed to the beams that we had to take off. So we had to prop the ceiling up inside so that didn't all fall off. But you were quite high up and, you know, you were sort of... I mean, now I don't worry too. Well, I don't worry about health and safety, but I think health and safety would be crazy because you're just up there. We made all these wooden ladders, and you're walking up the planks, and it's just I mean, South Georgia weather can be quite indifferent. So, you know, you're working in quite awkward conditions, and if the wind got too much, we just couldn't work. Mm. But fortunately, we had work indoors, or we could prepare things. But it went really well, in fact.
I mean, were you in restoring it to its original condition, or just making it weatherproof?
No, we did a... The army had done quite a good job on saving the roof, really, some years before, and I think they'd done a saving job as much as they were able to with the lack of materials. But we were trying to do as good a replacement job for years to come on it. So, you know, we did a really as good a job as we could, and a lot of the buildings got felt roofs. So it was put back with felt, so it was put back to its original design and how it looked in years gone by.
And who was paying the bill?
The Falkland Islands, the South Georgia government footed the bill, a lot of it. A firm called Jotel supplied the paint, who had supplied it from Norway before, and I think the Norwegian government and... There's quite a Norwegian whaling interest still in Norway, and I think they supplied money as well. And Bob Burton's quite well known down south, so he managed to scrounge us air transport down on the tour ships, which was quite good, which was fun. We had to give a lecture, give a talk on it. And as you're probably aware, I can chat away, so it wasn't too difficult.
And was that the last time you were in the Antarctic?
Yes, it was.
You haven't been back since?
No.
20-odd years?
No.
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 So you came back to Britain at the age of 50, I would guess, looking for a job.
Not really. I mean, I think what really made me come back was I was in South Africa, basically, and it was when things were changing, you know, with the Black government coming in, and it's a world recession as well, and doing the curios, it was one of the last things people want to buy. So it was sort of going through a little bit of a bad patch but really what brought me home was my mother. She was obviously getting older, and I hadn't lived in England for 40 years basically, and I just thought I'd like to come and spend time with my mother and live in England. Really, that's what brought me back in the end. But that was from Halley, in actual fact, because I'd come from Halley and I was in the Falklands, and I was going to go to South America and Sally, my present girlfriend, she phoned me and said, look, your mum's not well, I think you better come home. So I went home from the Falklands, from the Halley job, and, you know, my mum, in fact, died just after I got home. So that's really what... I guess stopped me really, and we had to come home with my mum, because I'd come home with mum, and then I'd gone just the summer to Halley. So I was in England basically, except I'd done the Halley contract. So that was really it. And then, of course, you get older and they don't want you anymore.
So did you actually get gainful employment back in Britain?
Yes, I did. Yeah, when I was an apprentice, when I talk about this for Munyans, there was another carpenter worked with me whose father owned a firm in the next village. And he then took the firm over, and because I knew this firm, Combers, and I ended up working with them. You know, I think I was up the yard scrounging timber. He said, oh, we're working in your village. OK, then, and I ended up going back with the Combers, and I've been there ever since, you know, until I retired.
And how was that? Was it a bit like a come-down after the excitement of overseas travel?
It was.
A carpenter back on your own...
Yeah, it was really difficult. I think having... South was definitely different. You know, you're there, and you're not your own boss exactly, because you're doing a job, but basically your own boss. And it's different. It's just different. And then I went to South Africa and I was doing the curios, so I was, you know, I was in offices.
Is it the scale that's different? It's more parochial, more petty, less challenging?
I think a lot of it is more parochial. I mean, one of the things, I mean, it's really difficult with the expatriates, you know, it's a when I's. Yeah. Have you heard that before, the when I's? When I was here, when I was there. And you get that. And I'd bump into people, and I'm probably quite bad at it. You know, just, it's really difficult not to say where you've been. And I think when... I'm losing track of what I'm saying. When I came back, you know, people would see me and say, "Oh, no, where you been then?" "Oh, I just come back from the Antarctic." "Oh, you know, where's that? That's where the polar bears are." No, it's the penguins, it's south. "Oh, what are the women like?" "No, there's no women." "What? No women?" "Oh, you know." And basically, they got you north or south of Brighton, there's no women. And then they said, "Did you see Coronation Street?" And that was it. You know, so, and it, that was quite, you know, you sort of think, well, people, after mixing with all these people and an interesting life, and it was quite a shock. And working in England was quite difficult to start with, too. I've only realised over the years, you know, you've got this lifestyle you've had for 40 years, and you come back and work on a building site in England, or, and it was quite difficult to get back into it.
Was it just, in the end at all?
I think it was just the sort of conditions, in a way. You know, you end up eating your sandwiches in somebody's garage, or it was still building south, but it, you know, but here it was just. I mean, we had a good job, and you get into it, and I worked in a lot of houses and nice people, but it was quite a shock getting back into the English way of doing things. And I was a bit out of touch with what, you know, how people went and how they did it. It didn't take long to get going again, you know, really. And I enjoyed it in the end. I really did enjoy what I did in the end. I'd still do little bits now with the firm.
So looking back over this 70, 71 years that you've been pottering around the planet, how highly does the Antarctic period rate in your scale of life experiences?
Oh, definitely at the top. Definitely at the top. You know, the Falklands is very high as well, because I had such a good time there. I've still got friends from there. I think with the Antarctic, again, it's such a different life, and it's just a wonderful place to be with what's there, and, you know, just the animals. To be able to just see these things and work among them and live among them, the penguins, the seals, the icebergs, the scenery, it's just wonderful. And I think it's the people you meet. You know, as I said, like Dave Hill, met him when I first went, still really friendly with him. Dad Etchells, the three of us are particularly friendly together. But there's other people that I've known all those years that, you know, we're really still, we're not quite so friendly with Dad, Fanny and I, but I'm still as equally friendly, but we don't see as much as each other, perhaps, you know, and so you've got this lifelong contact and what you've all done together.
Shared experience.
This shared experience. And of course, the longer you're away, the more you chat about it and the better it gets, you know, as the stories get longer. And because the girlfriends and wives go, "Oh, not again." You know, that's heard that before. But I think it is. It's just such a good experience. And I met, you know, it's just the people I've met. And it's
you say you're out of touch with bass, but you get the magazine
and your report.
What do you make of bass today?
Well, that's what I mean, I'm out of touch. You know, I don't really know what it must be like on the bases, you know, with the health and safety, the communications. I mean, when we did it, it was 100 words out in Morse code, 200 words in, done through bass office with the girls. I used to say to my mum, "Don't put anything silly in the air letters because everybody will read them." But, I mean, now it's just instant communication. And the other thing with us, because we went down on the Biscoe, there were all the various ships, and you got to know people, you were with them for a month at least on a tiny ship, but now they fly in. And when you read the magazines, it seems like the wintering people have a really good time together, and I doubt it's changed an awful lot, apart from the fact this communication, they can be in touch with home. But I'm not sure, I don't really know enough about it with the health and safety, what you can do, what you can't do, where you can go. I mean, things that we probably did that horrified people these days, leaping on and off the boats, you know, to transfer, you know, raging sea and be leaping off the boat into the launch hoping somebody caught you. You know, I guess those days are well gone. But I try to chat to people at these reunions that we're going to have tonight and try and get a feel of what's going on, but it's quite difficult at the moment to know, and I'm not sure. I mean, I think my age is against me now anyway, you know, with it would be too much of an age gap. But I'm not sure in a way now if I'd want to go back again. I'd like to go and see it again, possibly, to see what it is like. But I think the working to what we did, to what goes on now, I can't really relate to it because I don't really know enough, you know, with what is going on. But there you are.
John, thank you very much.